We are in the middle of this section that is known as the burdens of Isaiah. They are called burdens because they are prophecies that are kind of heavy. They're given to nations that have in times past been hard on God's people. The last few chapters, starting back in chapter 18 and then chapter 19, we saw prophecies that dealt with the Ethiopian and Egyptian kingdoms, and chapter 20 continues with actually those same kingdoms. Verse 1, in the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod, when Sargon the king of Assyria sent him, and fought against Ashdod and took it. So this is the year that this prophecy has come. At the same time, spake the Lord by Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saying, go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins, and put off thy shoe from thy foot. And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. And the Lord said, like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot 3 years, for a sign and wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptian prisoners and the Ethiopians captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. And they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and of Egypt, their glory. And the inhabitant of this isle shall say in that day, behold, such is our expectation, whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria, and how shall we escape? I'll give you a little background to some of this. Fascinating chapter. I was thinking originally when I first started studying it, we'll just kind of go quickly over this one. Verse 1, in the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod, let me show you a map where Ashdod is. Here's the land of Israel. Now the colors don't come out real good on here, but some of the maps I've been printing out, maps with modern-day borders. So you can't quite see, but it's kind of a pinkish area here where Israel comes down here and comes up here, around in here. And these areas, like up to this corner here and over here, and over in the little spot over here, are a little bit lighter because those are Palestinian or Syrian territories that they're trying to trade away right now. Here's Jerusalem. Ashdod's about 30 miles to the west of Jerusalem. Big bad Assyrians. They are the evil empire of the world. Assyria is, from this map there, Assyria would be like way over in the corner of that room on the map. And the Assyrians come up and they come down along the coast of the Mediterranean, and that's how they attack this land. They have already captured the northern kingdom of Samaria. This takes place when they capture Ashdod. They will eventually come all the way down. Egypt is down. Actually, Egypt is off the map, and Ethiopia is just south of that. Okay, so you got a picture of what we're looking at? Got that in your mind? Shake your head. Nod your head. Say, okay, I will turn it off. Okay. Okay. This prophecy, this strange word to Isaiah, comes in the year that the city Ashdod is taken. Tartan, who was one of the generals under King Sargon II, he captured Ashdod in 711 B.C., not at the 7-Eleven, it was in the year 7-Eleven. It wouldn't be, to try to place this historically, it would be another 10 years before Assyria would actually come against Jerusalem. Okay, this is kind of a precursor. And in fact, that would be under a different Assyrian king. Year 711. Ashdod, this city about 30 miles west of Jerusalem, it's about 3 miles inland from the coast. Its name means stronghold. It was an important city because it was on the main road from Egypt to Palestine. When Joshua had conquered the promised land, Ashdod, and those of you who've been coming on Sunday nights, we were going through all this stuff, you know, and I was telling you, you got to pay attention to this stuff because you're going to need to know. Ashdod was given to the tribe of Judah for them to conquer in Joshua chapter 15. It was supposed to be under their jurisdiction. And though it was given to the land to the tribe of Judah to conquer, it took them 700 years to do it. Because it was quite a stronghold. That's what its name meant. Very powerful city. In fact, it wasn't conquered until Hezekiah, who's the main king over Isaiah. It wasn't conquered until Hezekiah's grandpa, Uzziah. It's only belonged to Judah for 50 years when the Assyrians come up and take it. In fact, it is such a well-fortified place. Later when the Assyrians took it, they re-fortified it. And in a future battle down the road, when Egypt would come and try to take it, it took the Egyptians 29 years, a siege for 29 years to capture the place. I mean, this is one heavily fortified place. This is one heavy-duty city. That's kind of the focus of what's happening in this chapter, Ashdod. In the year that Ashdod is taken, this prophecy is given, verse 2. And at that same time spake the Lord by Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saying, Go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins, and put off thy shoe from thy foot. And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. We aren't told whether this was the sackcloth, whether this is what Isaiah wore all the time. Some of the prophets apparently did. John the Baptist wore sackcloth. Elijah, the prophet, wore sackcloth. Sackcloth is like a gunny sack. Okay, can you imagine wearing a t-shirt made out of a gunny sack? Okay, just picture that, folks, okay? It's not like a pleasant thing to wear. Why would in the world would people wear sackcloth? They would wear it as a sign of mourning or as a sign of repentance, great sadness. Almost like a way of beating yourself up. So the fact that Isaiah is wearing this is kind of significant. He's got a heavy heart over all this stuff. He's told to take off his sackcloth and take his sandals off. He is not going to be completely naked. Don't start getting wild ideas. He's still wearing his underwear. And it says he did so. Take off your outer garments, Isaiah, and your sandals. Go barefoot. Go do it. And it says, he did so. He did so, walking naked and barefoot. And the Lord said, like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot 3 years for sign and wonder upon Egypt. Now, some have suggested that this may not be the entire 3 years continuously. It may be like an off and on thing, like whenever he goes out for his ministry, then he does this. It could be. I don't know. But even as Isaiah has done this for 3 years, for a sign and a wonder upon Egypt and Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians prisoners and the Ethiopians captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered to the shame of Egypt. Now see, they would be entirely naked. Unlike Isaiah. God left him a little dignity. Don't think of this as some kind of a sexy thing. Don't think of this as like some kind of, man, that Isaiah is really one outrageous dude. You won't believe it. Oh man, you heard about in church, a guy's like walking around with those clothes on and he does it for God. Whoa. Has nothing to do with being outrageous. This is pure shame and humiliation. Now, as we've studied chapters 18 and 19 of Isaiah, I told you about how during one part of Isaiah's lifetime, Ethiopia and Egypt had been under a single king. They were ruled by a guy named Tirhaka, who was an Ethiopian. He ruled both areas, Egypt and Ethiopia. They were considered a mighty country. And there were, as we've talked about, there were some within the country of Judah. This is Hezekiah's country. There were some who were trying to encourage Hezekiah to make an alliance with Egypt and Ethiopia against the big bad Assyrians, because we need help, so let's hire some help, and so let's go to the Egyptians and the Ethiopians. But the whole point of this demonstration, it's in the year that Ashdod is taken, you know, like the stronghold. The Assyrians have taken Ashdod. And at that point, to try to ram home a point, God tells Isaiah, man, start walking around in your underwear and tell people that this is what the Assyrians are going to do to the Egyptians and the Ethiopians, who you want to trust in. You want to put all your hope that these guys are going to bail you out. But I'll tell you what, they're going to be worse than me. Assyrians are going to get them. They're not going to be able to stand against the Assyrians. Two lessons out of these verses. Number one is this, is to be a living witness. To be a living witness. It is not uncommon for God to ask His prophets to do something that would give them a chance to teach the people some kind of a lesson. When Ezekiel had his ministry, 100 or so years down the road from Isaiah, a couple hundred years, he was living in the land of Babylon. And he ministered primarily to the Jews who had been taken captive way off, far away in Babylon. And Isaiah was told to do some pretty outrageous things. Like, he had to lay on one side for a whole year in front of the people. And then he was told to make kind of like a little model of the city of Jerusalem. And he would kind of like set up his little army men and gun and stuff like that. And people would think, what's this, like a little kid or something? What's he doing? Actually, he was kind of a modern version of CNN. You know, he was telling the Babylonian captives play by play what was going on right then in Babylon. You know, and word would come from Jerusalem. Man, you couldn't hear. Can't believe what happened 2 months ago. Well, that's what Ezekiel was telling us 2 months ago. You know, in the New Testament, there was a prophet named Agabus, and he came up to Paul one day and he took Paul's belt off. Took Paul's belt off and tied himself up with it. And he said, in this way, the man who owns this belt will be bound. Sometimes God asks these prophets to do kind of some physical, goofy kind of things. People who hung around a prophet could expect to see some kind of a tangible demonstration of God's message to them. So here's the challenge. Can people see God's Word active in your life? I am not suggesting taking your clothes off like Isaiah. But the world shouldn't just hear us talking about Jesus. They ought to see us living it. A small town prosecuting attorney called his first witness to the stand in a trial. A grandmotherly, elderly woman. He approached her and he said, Mrs. Jones, do you know me? She responded, why, yes, I do know you, Mr. Williams. I've known you since you were a young boy. And frankly, you've been a big disappointment to me. You lie, you cheat on your wife, you manipulate people and talk behind their backs. You think you're a rising big shot, but you haven't the brains to realize you will never amount to anything more than a two-bit paper pusher. Yes, I know you. The lawyer was stunned. Not knowing what else to do, he pointed across the room to the other attorney. He said, "Well, Mrs. Williams, do you know the defense attorney?" She replied again, "Why, yes, I do. I've known Mr. Bradley since he was a little guy. I used to babysit him for his parents. And he, too, has been a real disappointment to me. He's lazy, bigoted, he has a drinking problem. The man can't build a normal relationship with anyone, and his law practice is one of the shoddiest in the state." Yes, I know him. At this point, the judge wrapped the courtroom to silence and called both counselors to the bench. In a very quiet voice, he said with a menace, "If either of you asks her if she knows me, you'll be jailed for contempt." So what do people know you for? What do people know you for? Do they know you as a person who lives out God's word? Or do they see you as, you know, some guy who's really just like they are? You say some things every once in a while when you're around other religious people, but, you know, but when you get away from the religious people, you're no different. How do people know you? Do they look at you as a person who has spent time with God? When Peter and John had been used by God to heal a lame man, the Jewish leaders wanted to know how they'd done this. And in Acts 4:13 it says, "Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were unlearned and ignorant men, they marveled. And they took knowledge of them that they had been with Jesus." You don't have to be a knowledgeable, learned person to be used by God or to speak for God. You just got to be someone who's been with Jesus, that people can see what God's doing in your life. Second lesson. We're talking about Isaiah walking around for 3 years in his underwear. Second lesson is this. Willing to be shamed. Isaiah was willing to do whatever God required. He was willing to do what it took for people to get the message. God wanted people to see that the Egyptians were not going to be victorious over the Assyrians. God wanted to make a vivid example that would stick in their minds. And, you know, and I've thought about this, you know, don't get the idea that everybody looks at Isaiah like he's some crazy nutcase that's just escaped from the mental asylum, and everybody's kind of going, "Oh, the poor fool. Oh, the poor fool." Gang, Isaiah has been established as God's prophet in Israel. This was the man who was one of the most trusted counselors to the king. This is a very serious dude. This is a very serious dude. He was willing to be shamed. Are we willing to do what is necessary to communicate the message? Are we willing to risk being called a fool for the chance of sharing God's message with people? Now, I don't think you need to worry here. God's not going to call us to run around in our underwear. In fact, Revelation 16:15, in case you were going to ask, I found a verse. It says, "Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his clothes on, lest he walk naked and they see his shame." So, okay, so you got a verse. So that's not what we're talking about. But you might risk feeling that kind of embarrassment. when you admit to your cool friends that you are a Christian. It's about the same kind of feeling, isn't it? Paul wrote in 1 Timothy 4:10, this is the New Living Translation, he says, "We work hard and suffer much in order that people will believe the truth. For our hope is in the living God, who is the Savior of all people, and especially of those who believe." The King James there says that we experience shame so that people will believe. When it comes time, when it comes to, you know, our faith is on the line, are you going to say something or not? They need to hear. I think it helps for us to remember that there was someone who was willing to suffer great humiliation for you and me. He wasn't only willing, but he actually did it. 2,000 years ago, the Creator of the universe allowed a bunch of puny men to mock Him, spit on Him, beat and whip Him, and they stripped Him of His clothes. They nailed Him to a cross, and they hung Him up high for everyone to see and mock at. He did it willingly for us. So is it too much for us to be willing to be shamed for Him? Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily hinders our progress. Let us run with endurance the race that God has set before us. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, on whom our faith depends from start to finish. He was willing to die a shameful death on the cross because of the joy he knew would be his afterward. Now he is seated in the place of highest honor beside God's throne in heaven." Isaiah, a living witness, willing to be shamed. Verse 5. "And they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and of Egypt, their glory." The Assyrian attack on Ashdod, with Isaiah's accompanying nakedness, were to remind the people that these alliances weren't going to do them any good. These particular alliances weren't going to do them any good. There is a danger that we run into when we put too much faith in people. When we put too much faith in people. I want to try to present this balanced. Relationships can be a very important thing for us. They are very, very important. God does not want us to be Lone Ranger Christians. We talked about this Wednesday night. Hebrews 3:12 says, "Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin." And so the whole point there in Hebrews 3 is that, you know, we need each other because basically I can fool myself into doing anything. You know, I can talk myself into doing anything. And you know what? I have done that. Have you ever done that? Have you ever talked yourself right into doing the wrong thing? I do it all the time, you know. But when we are around others, and maybe they're having a good day, and we're around them, and they're walking in the Lord, and they're greening, and they're beaming, you know, and they go, "What are you doing that for?" You know, to encourage one another. We need each other. It's important. But the problem is, people will let you down. There will be times when you are ashamed of them, just as Judah would be ashamed of the Egyptians. I see this kind of thing happening when people feel like they need to change churches. Sometimes it's people leaving our church, and sometimes it's people coming to our church who've left other churches. There's good reasons for leaving churches. There's some bad reasons for leaving churches. Personally, I think a bad reason for leaving a church is when I say, well, they hurt my feelings. I don't want to be around them anymore. You know what? Everywhere you go, where there are human beings who live and breathe and walk and talk, they will let you down. Everywhere you go, you will be let down. I believe maturity happens in our lives when we're willing to learn to face people even if they hurt us. Or we learn to tolerate people who rub us wrong. I mean, after all, don't we ever hurt the Lord's feelings? What is it? Did he give you the boot too? No, no. What I'm trying to say is this. We need people on one hand, but on the other hand, we're going to be disappointed. If we put too little faith in people, then we isolate ourselves and we don't receive the kind of encouragement we need. If we put too much faith in people, we get disappointed and we pull away. So be careful about putting too much faith in people. But don't pull away. We need each other a lot. Verse 6. And the inhabitant of this isle, or the word translated could mean coast, island, shore, or region. He's talking about the people who live in Judah. The inhabitant of this isle shall say in that day, behold, such is our expectation, whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria. And how shall we escape? If the powerful Egyptian people could be overcome by the Assyrians, what chance would little old Judah have? That's the whole point. And people are going to be going, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? I mean, like, the last hope is gone. What are we going to do? And in fact, actually, the Egyptians would be conquered by the Assyrians. It wouldn't happen for 40 years after this prophecy, but it'll happen. What are we going to do? Flee to the right place. That's the whole point. He says, whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria. How shall we escape? I mean, we were planning on fleeing to the Egyptians and saying, help us, help us, help us. Now where are we going to flee to? We have nowhere else to go except God. That's where we ought to be. That's a good place to be. Sometimes we flee to the wrong places and it doesn't work. Paul Harvey, in his book For What It's Worth, tells about a county jail in South Florida where jail officials found a plastic trash bag hanging in the bars of a cell. Inside was Jimmy Jones, a prisoner who hoped he'd get taken out with the trash. And he might have, except during roll call, his reflexes took over, and when the name Jimmy Jones was called, from inside the bag came a muffled response, "Hello." Fled to the wrong place. Sometimes the things we flee to are things like drugs and alcohol. Now, I've heard that the FDA may be considering some new warnings on beer and alcohol bottles, and this is some of the things they're considering. Warning, consumption of alcohol may make you think you are whispering when you're not. Warning, consumption of alcohol is a major factor in dancing like an idiot. Warning, consumption of alcohol may create the illusion that you are tougher, handsomer, and smarter than some really, really big guy named Kerry. Warning. we flee to the wrong places, don't we? When those big bad Assyrians are knocking at our door, it's too easy to flee to the wrong places. And what is really, really neat, I love Hezekiah. He's one of my favorite kings. I just love this guy. It can be really neat to meet Hezekiah when we get to heaven. He's a cool guy. Hezekiah learned. He learned. Let's look at 2 Chronicles chapter 32. Hezekiah is listening to all this. Remember, all of this takes place. The beginning of Isaiah's ministry, this three-year thing. This happens in 711 B.C. In 701 B.C. is where Hezekiah faces his test. It's in 701 that he finds the Assyrians knocking on his door. He's not just watching the CNN reports of what's happening down in Ashdod as one of his outer cities is being consumed. But in 701 B.C., they'll be at his door. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 32. After these things, this is after Hezekiah has gotten established as a king, he's brought a kind of a revival to the land. After these things and the establishment thereof, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came. Now Sennacherib is the guy who is king of Assyria after the guy we mentioned, Sargon, who was the king at the time of verse 1 of chapter 20. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and entered into Judah and encamped against the fenced cities and thought to win them for himself. And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes. Now there's a couple of things I've got underlined here. That's one of them. He took counsel. The enemy's knocking at his door. He took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city. And they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? And they're starting to think about, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? And so one of the ideas is to think, well, we'll make it a little bit hard for the Assyrians. And so there was Gihon? Is the spring that they stopped up? Where's my bill? Is it Gihon that they stopped up that Hezekiah's tunnel goes to? Oh, we can't remember. We'll have to check that one out. I'm winging it here. They took one of the springs that was outside the city, and they covered it all up. And he dug this incredible, it was quite an engineering feat, through solid rock. It was a couple hundred feet. He dug a tunnel from the well, from the spring, into the city, so that Jerusalem was taken care of water-wise, but there wasn't any water outside the city. And then it says, verse 5, also he strengthened himself and built up the wall that was broken. I mean, he took care of his defenses and raised it up to the towers and another wall without, built a second wall around the city and repaired Millo in the city of David, one of the strongholds, the towers, and made darts and shields in abundance, made weapons. And he set captains of war over the people and gathered them together to him in the street of the gate of the city and spake comfortably to them. To encourage them, saying, be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. Look at this. For there be more with us than with him. Doesn't that remind you of the verse in 1 John? Greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. Don't worry, guys. You know, they may have 185,000 guys out there in their army when they show up. We got more on our side. But King Hezekiah, we only got a couple thousand guys. What's the problem? You got a math problem here. Well, you know what, buddies? You're looking to the wrong people. With him, with the king of Assyria, with him is an arm of flesh But with us is the Lord, is Yahweh, our God, to help us and to fight our battles. And the people rested themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Now, see, 10 years earlier, he'd had a contingent of people encouraging him. You know, we gotta make this alliance with the Egyptians and the Ethiopians and all. And you know what? Sometimes alliances are okay. Don't throw all that out. You know, just like every time, can't trust anybody. No, we need people. Sometimes alliances are important. But God said no to that one. Hezekiah here is clearly trusting in the Lord. Doesn't that what it sounds like to you? Doesn't it sound like he's trusting in the Lord? Now, does that mean that he just sat around and prayed all day? Please don't get me wrong. We need to be praying. We need to be praying a lot. But what's he doing? He says he's trusting in the Lord, but my goodness, he's talking to counselors. They're stopping up wells. They're digging tunnels. They're building walls. They're building weapons. They're organizing the army. They're doing their drills, their push-ups, and everything. They're getting ready. And he says God's going to fight our battle, but you know what? They're still doing their thing. Trusting in the Lord means that we get our direction from the Lord, but then we do what God asks us to do. It doesn't mean that we don't talk to people or work to resolve the problem we're in. It means that we go to God first for our direction, and then we do what He leads us to do. Flee to the right place. Flee to the right place. Fleeing to the right place starts with fleeing to Jesus. It starts by understanding that there is no one who loves me more than Jesus. There is no one who knows better for me than Jesus. It's realizing that He loved me enough to take care of my biggest problem, my own sin. He loved me so much that He willingly gave up His life in my place, in a shameful, horrible death on a cross to pay for my sins. Fleeing to the right place means that if I'm going to run, I'm going to turn from my sins and run to Jesus first. There's an old hymn that just blew me away. I don't know, it's an old hymn. If you ever listened to J. Vernon McGee in the Bible Bus. How many of you listen to J. Vernon McGee in the mornings? Whoa! Cool! I love it! I love it! So you'll recognize this hymn. But gotta read you the whole hymn. How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in His excellent word. What more can He say than to you He hath said? What more can God say to you? To you who for refuge to Jesus have fled. Now here's what God says to you. This is what's so neat about this. It's a prophetic song. Fear not, I am with thee. Oh, be not dismayed, for I am thy God and will still give thee aid. I'll strengthen thee, help thee, and cause thee to stand upheld by my righteous, omnipotent hand. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace, all sufficient, shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to its foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. Flee to Jesus. He may tell you some things to do, you do them. But flee to Jesus. Let Him be your trust. Let Him be your hope. Let's stand and pray. Lord, I know that many of my precious brothers and sisters here, Lord, I know many are under all kinds of stress, trials, difficult times. We see the Assyrians marching off in the background. I pray, Lord Jesus, that perhaps You have identified for us, each of us, all different. I pray, Lord, that You have identified for us the kinds of things that we have trusted in that will not help. I pray, Lord, that You'd help us not to do our knee-jerk reaction of running to the wrong place whenever it gets hard. We want to learn to run to You. You are our refuge. You are our refuge. You are a place of safety. And You'll tell us what to do. You'll show us what needs to be done. You know, while we're standing here in prayer, our eyes closed, heads bowed, you know, it could be that maybe you're here this morning and you've never opened up your heart to Jesus. Maybe you've been to church before, you've heard religious stuff, you've sung some songs. But you know what? Jesus wants you to know Him. Not about Him. He wants you to know Him. And that starts by you asking Him to forgive you and asking Him to put His Spirit in your heart. It starts by you choosing to turn from your sin and choosing to follow after Him. He says in His Bible, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hears My voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and sup with him, have dinner, and he with Me." Then, friend, He is standing at the door of your heart. The tension that you feel, and the uneasiness that you feel, is because there's somebody who doesn't want you to know Him. And He'll make you run from Jesus. But there's no other place to run but to Him. If you want to take that step today of knowing Jesus, would you pray a prayer with me in your heart? It's up to you. I can't ask Him for you. You have to ask Him with your heart. And so if you pray with me, I'll help you out with some words. But it's really up to you and your heart calling out to Him. Would you pray this prayer with me? You will start to know Him. Pray with me. Dear Jesus, I need You. I need You to pay for my sins. I need Your forgiveness. I choose to turn away from my sins. And I choose to follow You. I open my heart to You. I want You to be my Lord.